Chapter 45. You didn't guess? Yes, I know. That is, of course I hoped. They looked at each other for an instant and again fell silent. Then, turning his eyes from hers, he asked abruptly, Ave, you told anyone else? Only Mama and your mother. She paused, and then added hurriedly, the blood flushing up to her forehead. Hattis and Ellen. You know I told you we'd had a long talk one afternoon and how dear she was to me. Ah, said Archer, his heart stopping. He felt that his wife was watching him intently. Did you mind my telling her first, Newland? Mind? Why should I? He made a last effort to collect himself. But that was a fortnight ago, wasn't it? I thought you said you weren't sure till today. Her color burned deeper, but she held his gaze. No, I wasn't sure then, but I told her I was. And you see I was right, she exclaimed, her blue eyes wet with victory. XXXIV. Newland Archer sat at the writing table in his library in East 39th Street. He had just got back from a big official reception for the inauguration of the new galleries at the Metropolitan Museum, and the spectacle of those great spaces crowded with the spoils of the ages, where the throng of fashion circulated through a series of scientifically catalogued treasures, had suddenly pressed on a rusted spring of memory. Why, this used to be one of the old Cisnola rooms, he heard someone say, and instantly everything about him vanished, and he was sitting alone on a hard leather divan against a radiator, while a slight figure in a long sealskin cloak moved away down the meagerly dash-fitted vista of the old museum. The vision had roused a host of other associations, and he sat looking with new eyes at the library which, for over 30 years, had been the scene of his solitary musings, and of all the family confabulations. It was the room in which most of the real things of his life had happened. There his wife, nearly 26 years ago, had broken to him, with a blushing circumlocution, that would have caused the young women of the new generation to smile, the news that she was to have a child, and their eldest boy, Dallas, too delicate to be taken to church in midwinter, had been christened by their old friend the Bishop of New York, the ample, magnificent, irreplaceable bishop, so long the pride and ornament of his diocese. There Dallas had first staggered across the floor shouting Ad, while May and the nurse laughed behind the door. There their second child, Mary, who was so like her mother, had announced her engagement to the dullest and most reliable of Reggie Chiver's many sons, and their Archer had kissed her through her wedding veil before they went down to the motor which was to carry them to Grace Church, for in a world where all else had reeled on its foundations, the Grace Church wedding remained an unchanged institution. It was in the library that he and May had always discussed the future of the children. The studies of Dallas and his young brother Bill, Mary's incurable indifference to accomplishments, and passion for sport and philanthropy, and the vague leanings toward art which had finally landed the restless and curious Dallas in the office of a rising New York architect. The young men nowadays were emancipating themselves from the law and business and taking up all sorts of new things. If they were not absorbed in state politics or municipal reform, the chances were that they were going in for Central American archaeology, for architecture or landscape engineering, taking a keen and learned interest in the pre-revolutionary buildings of their own country, studying and adapting Georgian types, and protesting at the meaningless use of the word colonial. Nobody nowadays had colonial houses except the millionaire grocers of the suburbs. But above all, sometimes Archer put it above all, it was in that library that the governor of New York, coming down from Albany one evening, to dine and spend the night, had turned to his host, and said, banging his clenched fist on the table and gnashing his eyeglasses, and the professional politician. You're the kind of man the country wants, Archer. If the stable's ever to be cleaned out, men like you have got to lend a hand in the cleaning. Men like you, how Archer had glowed at the phrase. How eagerly he had risen up at the call. It was an echo of Ned Winsett's old appeal, to roll his sleeves up, and get down into the muck. but spoken by a man who set the example of the gesture, and whose summons to follow him was irresistible. Archer, as he looked back, was not sure that men like himself were what his country needed, at least in the active service to which Theodore Roosevelt had pointed. In fact, there was reason to think it did not, for after a year in the State Assembly he had not been re-elected, and had dropped back thankfully into obscure, if useful, municipal work, and from that again to the writing of occasional articles in one of the reforming weeklies that were trying to shake the country out of its apathy. It was little enough to look back on. But when he remembered to what the young men of his generation and his set had looked forward, the narrow groove of money-making, sport and society to which their vision had been limited, even his small contribution to the new state of things seemed to count, as each brick counts in a well-built wall. He had done little in public life. He would always be by nature a contemplative and a dilettante. But he had had high things to contemplate, great things to delight in, and one great man's friendship to be his strength and pride. He had been, in short, what people were beginning to call good citizen. In New York, for many years past, every new movement, philanthropic, municipal or artistic, had taken account of his opinion and wanted his name. People said, S.K. Archer, when there was a question of starting the first school for crippled children, reorganizing the Museum of Art, founding the Grolier Club, inaugurating the new library, or getting up a new society of chamber music. His days were full, and they were filled decently. He supposed it was all a man ought to ask. Something he knew he had missed. The flower of life. But he thought of it now as a thing so unattainable and improbable, that to have repined would have been like despairing, because one had not drawn the first prize in a lottery. There were 100 million tickets in his lottery, and there was only one prize. The chances had been too decidedly against him. When he thought of Ellen Olenska, it was abstractly, serenely, as one might think of some imaginary beloved in a book or a picture. She had become the composite vision of all that he had missed. That vision, faint and tenuous as it was, had kept him from thinking of other women. He had been what was called a faithful husband, and when May had suddenly died, carried off by the infectious pneumonia through which he had nursed their youngest child, he had honestly mourned her. Their long years together had shown him that it did not so much matter if marriage was a dull duty, as long as it kept the dignity of a duty. Lapsing from that, it became a mere battle of ugly appetites. Looking about him, he honored his own past, and mourned for it. After all, there was good in the old ways. His eyes, making the round of the room done over by Dallas with English mezzotints, Chippendale cabinets, bits of chosen blue and white, and pleasantly shaded electric lamps, came back to the old Eastlick writing dash table that he had never been willing to banish, and to his first photograph of May, which still kept its place beside his inkstand. There she was, tall, round-bosomed and willowy, in her starched muslin and flapping leghorn, as he had seen her under the orange trees in the Mission Garden. And as he had seen her that day, so as he had remained, never quite at the same height, yet never far below it. Generous, faithful, unwearied, but so lacking in imagination, so incapable of growth, that the world of her youth had fallen in two pieces, and rebuilt itself without her ever being conscious of the change. This hard, bright blindness had kept her immediate horizon apparently unaltered. Her incapacity to recognize change made her children conceal their views from her as Archer concealed his. There had been, from the first, a joint pretense of sameness, a kind of innocent family hypocrisy, in which father and children had unconsciously collaborated. And as he had died thinking the world a good place, full of loving and harmonious households like her own, and resigned to leave it, because she was convinced that, whatever happened, Newland would continue to inculcate in Dallas the same principles and prejudices which had shaped his parents' lives, and that Dallas in turn, when Newland followed her, would transmit the sacred trust to little Bill. and of Mary she was sure, as of her own self. So, having snatched little Bill from the grave, and given her life in the effort, she went contentedly to her place in the Archer vault in St. Mark's, where Mrs. Archer already lay safe from the terrifying grand which her daughter-in-law had never even become aware of. Opposite May's portrait stood one of her daughter. Mary Chivers was as tall and fair as her mother, but large-waisted, flat-chested and slightly slouching, as the altered fashion required. Mary Chivers' mighty feats of athleticism could not have been performed with the 20-inch waist that May Archer's azure sash so easily spanned. And the difference seemed symbolic. The mother's life had been as closely girt as her figure. Mary, who was no less conventional, and no more intelligent, yet led a larger life, and held more tolerant views. There was good in the new order too. The telephone clicked, and Archer, turning from the photographs, unhooked the transmitter at his elbow. How far they were from the days when the legs of the brass-buttoned messenger boy had been New York's only means of quick communication. Chicago wants you. Ah, it must be a long distance from Dallas, who had been sent to Chicago by his firm, to talk over the plan of the Lakeside Palace they were to build for a young millionaire with ideas. The firm always sent Dallas on such errands. Hello, Dad, yes. Dallas. I say, how do you feel about sailing on Wednesday? Mauritania. Yes, next Wednesday as ever is. Our client wants me to look at some Italian gardens before we settle anything, and has asked me to nip over on the next boat. I've got to be back on the 1st of June, the voice broke into a joyful conscious laugh. Oh, we must look alive. I say, Dad, I want your help. Do come. Dallas seemed to be speaking in the room. The voice was as nearby and natural as if he had been lounging in his favorite armchair by the fire. The fact would not ordinarily have surprised Archer, for long-distance telephoning had become as much a matter of course as electric lighting and five-day Atlantic voyages. But the laugh did startle him. It still seemed wonderful that across all those miles and miles of country, forest, river, mountain, prairie, roaring cities and busy indifferent millions, Dallas's laugh should be able to say, of course, whatever happens, I must get back on the 1st, because Fanny Beaufort and I are to be married on the 5th. The voice began again. Think it over? No, sir. Not a minute. You've got to say yes now. Why not? I'd like to know. If you can allege a single reason, no, I knew it. Then it's a go, eh? Because I count on you to ring up the Cunard office first thing tomorrow. And you'd better book a return on a boat from Marseille. I say, Dad, it'll be our last time together, in this kind of way. Oh, good. I knew you would. Chicago rang off, and Archer rose, and began to pace up and down the room. It would be their last time together in this kind of way. The boy was right. They would have lots of other times after Dallas's marriage, his father was sure. For the two were born comrades, and Fanny Beaufort, whatever one might think of her, did not seem likely to interfere with their intimacy. On the contrary, from what he had seen of her, he thought she would be naturally included in it. Still, change was change, and differences were differences, and much as he felt himself drawn toward his future daughter-in-law, it was tempting to seize this last chance of being alone with his boy. There was no reason why he should not seize it, except the profound one that he had lost the habit of travel. May had disliked to move except for valid reasons, such as taking the children to the sea or in the mountains. She could imagine no other motive for leaving the house in 39th Street or their comfortable quarters at the Wellands in Newport. After Dallas had taken his degree as he had thought it her duty, to travel for 6 months. And the whole family had made the old-fashioned tour through England, Switzerland, and Italy. Their time being limited, no one knew why they had omitted France. Archer remembered Dallas's wrath at being asked to contemplate Mont Blanc instead of Reims and Chartres. But Mary and Bill wanted mountain climbing, and had already on their way in Alice's wake through the English cathedrals. And May, always fair to her children, had insisted on holding the balance evenly between their athletic and artistic proclivities. As he had indeed proposed, that her husband should go to Paris for a fortnight, and join them on the Italian lakes, after they had won Switzerland. But, Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.